I know why everybody left this podium.
Okay. My sobriety date is December 20th, 1970. I'm a member in fairly good standing of the Mount Pleasant High Noon Group. My sponsor is named Paula. And I tell you those things because I think that those three things are the things that help me stay sober on a daily basis, and they're very important to me. I, too, am very nervous. I've spoken at meetings before through the years, but I never really get used to the idea that I'm catapulted from my green corduroy drinking chair to a room full of sober alcoholics. And I love the idea that the help outside this room is terrified that we will all go out at once. What would they do? I mean, yeah, what would they do? I was born in Iowa. And I was born to a middle-class family. I had a reasonably ordinary upbringing, except for a couple of things. In my family, on both sides, as far back as I'm aware of, runs this very persistent thread of alcoholism. My grandfather, George, wrote a family history. I think that was kind of the thing that you did back in the 20s. And there's a person, I've read that family history several times, but it was just a few years ago that I realized that Jamie, whoever he was, in 1850, had to be moved. Everybody sold everything and everyone took Jamie to Tama County, Iowa, because Tama County was a dry county. And my uncles and my cousins on that side of the family, there are many that are alcoholic. On my mother's side, there is also a long strain of alcoholism. I have a cousin who really couldn't take the pain of alcoholism anymore, and he shot and killed himself. And his son was to do the same thing. And I remember when I was drinking that I had said to myself, I was not going to be like this. I didn't know a whole lot about my grandfather and my aunt and my cousins and my uncles and all these people because we didn't talk about alcoholism at my house. I think part of the reason was that both my parents were pretty, they had pretty skinned knees over what they'd experienced in their own homes. And my mother, I don't know to this day whether I should typify her as an alcoholic or not, but I'll let you decide. When I was a very young child, my mother would go to parties, and she would come home from parties, and on my best day, I couldn't do this. She would call me into her room in the morning, and the room just reeked of garlic and booze. And she would say, "Get me a glass of milk." I'd bring her a glass of milk, and we'd talk over the night before at the party that she had been at. And it was clear to me, it's clear to me now, that whatever had gone on at these parties, she wasn't all that comfortable there. She maybe said something wrong, did something that made her self-conscious, whatever. And we would rework this event, this party, or maybe an argument with my father, or whatever. And we would rework this story of what happened last night over and over and over again until they were to blame and she was Lily White. It sounds familiar, huh? Yeah. I was rather frightened by watching my mother drink. I was certainly frightened when I'd get in the car with her and she would drive and gaily announce she had never been in an accident, you know, while she's backing up a highway or something. I was sort of frightened of her. She was not emotionally very dependable. I didn't know if she was going to be happy, sad, or glad. And I, as a teenager, I sort of made this compact with myself that no matter what happened in my life, I would never be like that. I would never be like that. Never is a word that if you're an alcoholic, you probably ought to just leave that one out. And, of course, I was to become almost exactly like that, and maybe a bit sadder, I don't know. But I made that contract, and I broke it. And that's the reason I'm here tonight, to tell you how that contract with myself got broken, my experience. I think I drank, as I understand it, for about 12 years. What happened? Why did I stop? What happened one day that I just didn't drink anymore? And what is my life like now in these 28 years that I have been sober? I think every convention is a celebration, an enormous celebration of something that's almost impossible to imagine, and that's that you can take an alcoholic and they will stop drinking if they are given a fellowship. On the theme of this particular convention, as I understand it, is trudging the road to happy destiny. I remember the first time I read that sentence, and I thought it sounded pretty grim. And I looked it up before I came over here tonight, and there's another sentence on that particular page that I like very much, and it says that in Alcoholics Anonymous you will find the fellowship you crave. And I think this is interesting because the book begins with a craving. There are two cravings, apparently, that exist in us. One of them is for alcohol. And if we substitute fellowship, we seem to recover. Trudging means, I looked this stuff up in the dictionary to give myself time for my heart rate to go down. Trudging means, really, walking on a path. That really is all it means. It has a lot of connotations, but what it really means is walking on a path. And destiny is a goal, walking on a path. And happiness is being in fellowship with other people. So it's not a tedious and lonesome trip. It's walking in company with all of us together, helping each other stay sober. So I was born in Iowa into this family. And the interesting thing to me is that I had in some way, you know, kids are not very dumb. They're terribly bright. They watch, they listen, they hear, they make judgments, and they come to understandings. And however faulty their thinking, they're watching all the time. And I was one of those watchful children. And that's my grandson. I made a decision that I wouldn't be like my mother. And at the same time, my family, my mother and my father, tried to educate me about how to drink properly. And I remember that when I was in high school, my father made up a jar of martinis and put it in the icebox for me so that I could have a martini before dinner. I was taught about red wine and pink wine and white wine and when you drank it. It was the habit of the kids in my crowd that we would go to other people's houses, the parents would leave, and we would have drinking parties. And I thought that if you were an alcoholic, that you responded to these sorts of things in a very particular way. That is, if you even sniffed alcohol, you started foaming at the mouth, rolling your eyes, and getting down on the floor and waving your arms and your legs. And I didn't do any of those things. When I went to those drinking parties, I didn't drink. When I was introduced to alcohol in my home, I didn't sneak in and take some when nobody was around. I didn't fake an ID to pretend that I was an age so I could get a drink in a bar. I didn't do these things. And so later, as I was trying to understand what was happening to me, that was kind of confusing to me because I didn't have an instant response. It was a slow slide down. I do remember my first drink, though. You know, my first drink. The one that made me feel so good. And that was at the Gay 90s bar in Rock Island, Illinois. I was of an age to drink. I was out with a naval midshipman in full dress uniform. And I knew that I was very grown up because at the Gay 90s bar, there was a portrait, an oil painting of a nude over the bar. So I was feeling quite grown up. And when the young man asked me what I'd like to drink, I said I'd like a whiskey sour. I had the faintest idea what a whiskey sour was, but I saw it on the menu there, and I thought that sounded kind of cool, so I had a whiskey sour. Now, before I'd had this whiskey sour, I'd been sort of a quiet person at the party. after the whiskey sour, two very spiritual things happened to me. The first spiritual thing that happened to me was that a hole in my stomach that I had been carting around since I could remember, that I didn't know was there, filled up. I don't know how to explain it any better, and I've really, in a room full of alcoholics, rarely had to explain it. Something filled up. I felt safe, comfortable. I didn't feel awkward. I felt like I belonged. And the second spiritual thing that was happening to me was I opened up. I started talking and laughing and joking and dancing. I had a wonderful, wonderful time. And I apparently never forgot this wonderful, wonderful time because I went back to this drinking later. I wanted to be an actor. And at first I went off to a school called Newton College of the Sacred Heart in Boston. And it was there that I met the man that I was going to marry. And I remember we would go out and we would drink. But nothing bad. I don't remember having any remorse or guilt or fear. I still wasn't frothing at the mouth and waving my arms and legs in the air. I do remember a weekend at Yale where I got so rip-roaring drunk, I can't begin to tell you. And that was back in the days when girls wore those 3-inch spike heels. And the whooping poofs, whatever they are, sacred thing to Yale, were singing away in the room there. And I just went over to the ladies' room, and I just laid down on that cool tile bathroom floor. And I just watched all those high heels go. I think, I don't remember whether Harvard won or lost. All I know is that Dibbs, who's my husband, got stuffed up a fireplace someplace, and that the ride home was wicked long, man. I had a bad headache. But, you know, it was fun. It was funny. It was fun. I did go off to drama school in New York City. I went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. And, you know, this is really sad. And for potential parents, just let me tell you, if, you know, to send an alcoholic to drama school, it isn't necessary. So I went to drama school, and I got ideas about myself. You know, I have this grandiosity that they talk about in the 12 and 12, and I could see my name in lights. It wasn't, you know, it was going to take a little while, and I'd probably have to smile at somebody, and I might have to act once in a while, but it was only a matter of time. Well, I washed out of drama school in a year, and so I called this guy up, and he came to see me, and we decided to become man and wife. We got married. And he wanted to go to graduate school, and so we went to Ames, Iowa, where he went to graduate school. Well, during this time, you know, gay 90s bar, New York, whiskey sours, I had, like, gotten a few ideas about things. And they did not include changing beds, doing dishes, going to work. I believe we were in a dry county. Come to think of it. Well, I think we must have been because we made our own booze. I have this little orange tree that he gave me just so many years ago. And so we put some oranges in some, I don't know what kind of alcohol it was. We called it Cointreau. We played cards. And I woke up the next morning, I still had gin in my hand, undeclared. Just shoom, passed right out. So he graduated, and we went back to Boston. But I had started to have an attitude. I was angry that I was second, that I wasn't the primary person in the family that everybody was paying attention to. I was angry that I had to help somebody else achieve their goals. I had no sense of sharing. And I remember the night before my husband's oral exam. You know, and you just, these people work real hard to study stuff about bugs and everything. It's real important. And so he had this oral exam. And the night before, I was feeling kind of like lonesome, you know, and I'd had a few drinks. And I decided to get a little attention, so I decided to commit suicide. You know, it's Wednesday, let's commit suicide. So what I did was I opened the oven, and I pulled the rack out, and I turned the gas on, and I opened the doors and the windows, and I laid my face down on that rack, and I just waited for death to come. And, of course, he had to stay up with me all night long. He really tanked on his oral exams. His professors didn't understand what was wrong. I didn't have any thought about him or his future or anything else. I was very full of myself. I was very worried about me. We went back to Boston, and he went to work, and I had a baby. I have three children, and I drank through every single one of those pregnancies. I was beginning to do the things that I had sworn that I would never, ever do. And I began to become frightened. I think this was maybe about the seventh year of my drinking. I became frightened. I hated people. I hated my life. I hated myself. And I didn't understand why. And I got myself into a pattern. And it can pick up at any point in a 24-hour day. You know, let's say about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I've decided early that morning that I will never drink again. There's that word again. Never, never drink again. And so I've got to find a reason to drink again because it's like 3:30, you know. Clock is ticking. So I'm thinking, well, you know, nothing really bad happened today. Nothing really good happened today. How am I going to get a drink today? I don't know. And I was in the habit, because I certainly didn't want to have my children see me drinking, of putting my children to bed before I would drink. Now, it's 3:30 and it's, you know, it's so slow. The clock is ticking so slow and it's 4:30. And go, oh, and in Boston, you know, it gets dark real early. They don't know. So I put those children to bed like 4:30, 4:45 in the afternoon. I never loved my children so much. Kisses, love you all, bang. And I'd go downstairs, and you know, I'd be pulling all the shades down. The other children, of course, are out playing in the street, and they'd say, "But mommy, mommy, why do we have to go to bed?" And I'd say, "Because their parents are really bad parents. They don't have good parents, me." And I'd go downstairs and I'd stand in front of my liquor cabinet door and I would say, will I or will I not drink today? Well, nothing really great happened today. Nothing really terrible happened today. I can't think that I really should need to drink today. And then I get this like split personality. This little voice would say to me, you know, you're being very reasonable about whether you will or will not drink today. I think you're being very calm about it. I don't really think you have to worry about it. I don't think you have a problem. Why don't you have a drink? Thanks, I will. And I would go to my liquor cabinet, and I would have my first coffee cup full of gin. I'd like to explain that. First of all, gin is only, if you go to the Joy of Cooking book, and I use the Joy of Cooking cookbook perhaps a little differently than it was intended, but they list the calories of all the booze that you can drink. And I was on a diet. So I put myself on 1,000 calories worth of gin a day. And gin is only 70 calories an ounce. Well, I don't know how I got from that to a coffee cup. Oh, yes, I do, because if somebody came to my house, nobody came to my house. I didn't know anybody. If somebody came to my house, I could put my coffee cup in the sink and no one would be any the wiser. Nobody came to my house. I would go into my green drinking chair and I would put on the music. You guys know the music? The music tells you who you should have married, where you should have been living, how many maids you should have. what ball gown you'll be wearing this evening, you know, the music. And I'd sit there and I would bawl my eyes out. It was wonderful. And I remember that first, you know, swallow of gin. My husband says I don't even drink water right. I didn't sip gin. I bolted it. And it would hit my throat, you know, it'd be that fire, and then it hit your stomach, fire again, and then all your fingers and toes and everything, and go, yes, yes, now I feel whole again, I feel safe again, I feel comfortable again, I feel okay again. Well, my husband would come home from work, and he was sort of looking for something called dinner. I, you know, dinner was going to be any minute now because I was making, you know, something that required a half a cup of red wine in it. And I knew that, you know, as I go out and just have a little more red wine, it'd be ready any minute. And I kind of like wanted to have like an intelligent conversation. I wanted to dance in the kitchen. I mean, it's Wednesday, you know, let's live a little. He really didn't want to do that. And then I would suggest, well, let's have a martini then, you know, the old dumpy guy, you know, let's have a martini. So he'd fix a martini and he'd sip it. Now you guys have all been with people like this. The ice melts, you know, the sweat is running down the outside of the glass. My glass is empty. You know, I'm flicking my foot like this. And he would just like push that drink over and let me drink it. We had an elephant in our living room, and we didn't talk about it. We were young. I don't think we really understood what was happening. We started having fights, bad fights, terrible fights. But they were really, you know, Wednesday night at the fights. I'm bored, see, and I don't care about you. I'm bored. Let's turn the TV on. The best and worst fight we ever had was in Lexington, Massachusetts. The best fights are you're on the inside bathroom door, they're on the outside. And you're shouting stuff and they're shouting stuff and temperature's rising. And he said something and I decided, well, I'm going to kill myself. You know, that's what I always do. I'm going to kill myself. So I jumped out of the bathroom window 2 feet to a snowbank. Below in my nightie. And I had to run around the house and knock on the door real polite and hope he'd let me in again. I also tried to commit suicide once by taking 4 aspirin instead of 2. It was long about now that I decided I needed some help. My oldest child was maybe 3 years old. 3 years old. And I remember sitting down with Amy. I don't know, I just thought, well, you know, she just come from heaven, I guess, you know, about 3 years ago. Maybe she remembers something. I don't know. I called my 8th grade English teacher in Tacoma, Washington, Miss Madsen. And I wanted to have Miss Madsen tell me what's wrong with me. Do you remember something about me in the 8th grade? Did I write a funny essay at any time or anything? And she said, I'm very sorry, dear. I don't really know what to tell you. You did get A's in English, but other than that, I really don't recall much about you. The phone call, the bill for that was astronomical. And since I had to hide from the postman, I really did hide from the postman. He would come down the street, and I would, like, duck under this shelf. I'm a grown woman with 3 kids. I'm ducking under the shelf till he should go and put the mail in the slot and move on. Found out later he was a drunk. takes one to know one, I guess. I don't know. I hid that phone bill till the next month because, you know, they don't put the charges on the second month's bill if you haven't paid it. So it was astronomical, but we didn't know what happened or why that was. I remember when Dibs kind of got into the game a little bit. I don't know if there's anybody here that remembers the old James Bond movies. There was one movie where James Bond was trying to protect his guns from the enemy. And so he put a he took a hair out of his head and he put it across the gun cabinet doors, and he would know if anybody opened that cabinet. And it was my habit, after we hadn't had dinner and I didn't do the dishes and we hadn't danced in the kitchen, but we'd had a really good fight, that we'd go upstairs and watch TV, and I'd ask Don if he didn't want like a dish of ice cream. And he'd say yes, he'd like a dish of ice cream. Well, that was my signal. I'd go down and I would take a little pop out of the bottle from the liquor cabinet. And for some reason, I used to stand at my kitchen window and go, "Here's to you, Esther," my next-door neighbor. I don't know why I did that. I didn't even know Esther. Anyway, this one night I went down, and there was a hair across the liquor cabinet door. And I saw it. So I took it off. I opened the liquor cabinet. I drank what I wanted, and I put the hair back across the liquor cabinet. We had trouble at our house. The lawn was mowed, the bushes were trimmed, the house was painted, and it was a real disaster going on in there. I decided, once again, I'm sorry, this is repetitive, but I decided once again to kill myself. And this was after my birthday. This was December 20th, 1970, which was my last drink. My husband gave me a birthday present on his birthday. I've never had things so racked up like that ever since. Never. And I had absolutely no sense of gratitude for that gift, although how he ever came up with any kind of love that was just shining in his eyes, because he gave me something I had really wanted very much that we couldn't afford. And I didn't care. I remember looking at the gift and going, "That's nice, but my glass is empty." And it was like a low. You know, everybody's got their own spot where they get off, but to see that person, after all I'd put him through, see that kind of shiny smile on his face, and to not care at all, was bad. And I remember going down to commit suicide in my basement, because I kept all the plant materials across from the washing machine, and there was some Malathion there, and I was going to drink it. Only I really was going to drink it. Because I was sick and tired of being me. I was sick and tired of making a fool out of myself. I was tired of waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning and feeling this awesome lonesomeness and this terrible sense of being cut off from everybody else in the universe. I remember looking out the window and watching the world go by, and I didn't feel connected to it at all. And the grace of God came into my life. And it came in such a way that I got an idea into my head. I say God said. I can't really say he spoke to me, but the idea came very strongly. Call AA. AA. I don't know what that is. I saw the Days of Wine and Roses, and I think my uncle went to AA, and he's a drunk. He never... Oh, all right. So I go and get the phone book, and I call AA. Now, I did know a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous, although I didn't know anything about it. And I knew that they had a big situation board down in their office, and every street and house would light up if you called. But I called them anyway. And so it was Monday morning, and this person was very bright and breezy, and this is Boston now. I said, "You're having a little trouble with booze, sweetheart." No, it was nothing like that. If you'd like send me something in an envelope without my name on it, without an address, I'll read it and I'll... "Can't do that, honey. Have to have your name and number." So I gave him my name and my number. And I hung up the phone and I thought, what have I done? You know, I know that that light is blinking in the situation room at Alcoholics Anonymous. So the phone rang again, and I think this is again where the grace of God entered my life, because I answered it. And it was a woman named Martha. And Martha was doing something that, well, I sort of still aspire to, but I really did on that Monday morning. It was 10 o'clock on a Monday morning, and Martha was eating pizza. And I thought, you know, if I could ever have my stomach to where I could eat pizza in the morning, I think life would be pretty grand. I had very low goals in those days. So Martha took me to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. It was at Metropolitan State Hospital, which is an institution for drunks and other ne'er-do-wells. And I'll never forget driving to this meeting with Martha. She said, we're going to go to Metropolitan State Hospital, kid, and by the way, I forgot to tell you, I'm an epileptic, so if I should happen to have a fit on the way over to the Metropolitan State Hospital, just pull the car over and call the cops, everything will be fine. I'm going, I want to go home. We're going to Metropolitan State Hospital, it's that inky green, you know, actually the walls were the same color as my green drinking chair, that just real bad green color, and people banging their heads against the wall, and they were locked up and caged up, and these other very happy, normal people came up, and they did what I'm doing right now, they told their stories, people were laughing, some of them were kind of, aw, like that, but other people that were with it were listening, and as I listened to these people talk, I was very impressed. Maybe the second meeting I went to, I met Bottles. Bottles came up to me. I don't know how he picked me out. I have no idea. But he picked me out and he came up and he put his arm around me like an angel. And he said, "We're so glad you're here, honey. We're so glad you're here." And he just looked at me and he said, "You're going to be okay." I thought, I don't think I've ever met anybody so beautiful as this guy named Bottles. Bottles used to walk down in Cambridge with this coat where he'd sewn all these little pockets for nips. So he just kind of rattled as he walked down the street. That's why he was called Bottles. He was a wonderful old gentleman. I remember getting up at the end of the meeting and saying the Lord's Prayer together. And I'd been to church. I don't ever remember saying the Lord's Prayer like that. I don't ever remember hearing people really mean it like that. Really impressed. I wanted to be like you guys when I grew up, real bad. So I started going to AA meetings in my hometown, and I got a sponsor. I didn't want a sponsor. I don't know what a sponsor is, and I'm going to be his pigeon. I don't want to be anybody's darn bird. So there really were like no women there. So they said, "You see that really big man over there in the corner? You go ask him to be your sponsor." That was Ray. He weighed about 420 pounds, and he had a voice to go with it. Loud. And he really wasn't interested in my philosophy of life or whether I had read Schopenhauer or anything. He'd say, "You know, the reason you got two ears and one mouth, supposed to listen twice as much as you talk, take the cotton out of your ears, stuff it in your mouth, sit down and shut up." "You can't talk to me like that. I'm from the suburbs." It was our habit to go out on what were called commitments. Your group would go to another group, and each member of your group would maybe speak for 5 or 10 minutes, and then that group would come back to your group on your meeting night and give a meeting. And we went all over Greater Boston that way. And it was, maybe after I'd been sober 3 or 4 months, it was the first time I saw a drunk, a real drunk in an AA meeting. And I knew he was a drunk because he had an army overcoat on, he had a sneaker and an overshoe, and he had brass knuckle dents from being beat up all over his face and a couple teeth missing. Well, I got up to tell my story. Maybe it was the first or second time I'd ever told my story. And he started kind of like chuckling, you know. And so I straightened myself. I'm from the suburbs. And I went on with my story. And long story short, by the time I sat down, he was slapping his knee and he was laughing his head off. And when the meeting was over, he came up and he slapped me on the shoulder and he said, "I identified with you right down the line, sister." I thought, well, we've had two different lifestyles here. I don't think I understand it. So I went skittering over to Ray to ask him what that meant. And he said, "You just learned a very important lesson. It doesn't matter who you are, why you drank, what you drank, how much you drank, who you drank it with. It's what happened to you when you did. And the same thing that happened to you happened to that man. And he identified with you. And it was kind of a nice moment. It was a kind of a nice moment. I have another favorite drunk. He was walking in front of the Boston Public Library. You know how sometimes you see someone and you just see them for a minute and they're you? This guy, again, you know, odd dress and clearly drunk, face as red as a fireball, and he had red hair which stuck straight up all over his head, and he was drunk and he was walking like in the gutter and on the sidewalk, and he fell. And he fell right on his face. And I was like afraid to even see him stand up. And he did. He kind of unwound himself, and he stood up, and he looked around for a minute, and he pulled a comb out of his back pocket, and he started doing this. Blood everywhere. And I said, yes, that's me. That's me. First things first. I got it. After I was sober about a year, Dibs wanted to go and live in Portugal. And in those days, there was no AA in Portugal. And so we went screaming off. Of course, you know, in a sense, I'd consented to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't really need you guys. It was just God and me, this God that I didn't even know or believe in. It was just God and me, and I didn't need you guys. And this God I didn't really, you know, like, believe in called my bluff, and he sent me off to Portugal with no AA. I didn't have to bother with you guys at all. You weren't there. So we started a meeting in downtown Lisbon, what I lovingly call the combat zone of Lisbon, kind of tiptoe through all the things on the street and up into this little church where this priest would let us have our meetings. It was a fascinating AA meeting. I bet you haven't been one like this. The priest was a member of the brotherhood that made Bagacinho, or White Lightning. And he used to bring Dibs an entire flagon of White Lightning and one for himself. They would light it, and then they'd blow the fire out. They'd sip their Bagacinho for the hour while a deaf-as-cod Englishman and a Portuguese who hated the Englishman and I had an AA meeting. I didn't think I was going to stay sober through that. I really didn't. I was very frightened, and I didn't think I was going to make it. But I did make it, and the reason I made it is because my sponsor sent me letters and my friends from the program sent me letters because I did try to start a meeting, because I signed up I can't think of it, in New York, and so that if anybody's going through Lisbon or someone has a call and wants help from their alcoholism, they'll give you a call. And I met fascinating people. I met Goanese croupiers. I met a Irish jockey whose favorite habit was to get drunk and ride his horse through the bar. They sent him home in a white jacket, no lie. And I came home again. And that's what happened. What it's like now, there's some things that I can think to share with you. You know, I think very often we think when we come into AA that somehow we'll kind of right our boat and things will go well forever and ever, amen. And that's not necessarily my experience. Life still happens even though you're sober. And after about 5 years in the program, my marriage wasn't doing so well. I mean, we were taking care of the children, and we were paying the bills, and we were going to the mother-in-law's on Sundays, but my marriage wasn't doing very well. And my husband had gone off on one of his trips to Europe someplace, and, you know, I'm thinking, I hope the damn plane crashes, you know? And I remember having a real dialogue with myself and my higher power about this, because I really thought things were supposed to get better. And I didn't feel like they were getting better. I mean, I wasn't drinking anymore, but it was empty in that house. And I wandered around for that week, and I sort of said to God, you know, God, I really don't know what you want me to do. I feel like I've tried to work the steps. I feel like I've tried to do everything that you've asked me to do, and I don't feel that I've really made any progress in my marriage. And I remember going down on my knees at about 8 o'clock on Sunday morning and saying, I really don't know what you want me to do about my marriage. And God said, well, that's the trouble, kid. It isn't your marriage. It's mine. They're not your children. This isn't your house. It isn't your sobriety. It's mine. And I want you to turn it over. I want you to turn it over. And I thought, I think I will turn it over. And the phone rang. It was my husband calling from London. It was 3 o'clock in the morning in London. And he asked me to marry him again. He said he'd seen an enormous change in me. And he felt, too, that maybe our marriage really wasn't all it was supposed to be. And that he'd like to get married again. Well, I hung up that phone and I started planning, what do I wear? Who am I going to invite? Who will be the caterer? And God says, hey, you remember me? I just did this incredible thing. Remember, it's 8 o'clock here, it's 3 o'clock there, yada, yada, yada. You know, turn it over. Maybe he'll forget all about this when he gets home. If he does, that's got to be okay with you. Okay, okay. So when I got home, he hadn't forgotten. And we went to this priest and we asked if he would remarry us, give renewal of marriage vows. We took our children out of school, and I'll never forget this. It was just, you know, my children, my husband and myself and this priest, and he's having us renew our marriage vows. And Amy is bumping Jesse and going, I thought they were married. And I went back to school telling I don't know what. We had our wedding dinner at McDonald's. We had our honeymoon at the Arnold Arboretum. I guess what I'm trying to say is it wasn't some great big star-filled thing. It was ordinary life in a beautiful, beautiful way. Something that happened as a result of being sober that I really didn't have a whole lot to do with. And it was a very blessed day. It was a lovely day. I can remember, I have no idea when I started talking, so I don't know how long I should go, but I remember when I had to leave Boston in my home group. I don't know if any of you have ever had that experience, but I had to leave my home group. Everyone who I knew from day one, who knew me, I had to leave everything and go to Birmingham, Alabama, and it was really tough. I remember getting in the car and driving and turning on the music and crying and crying and crying. I was so homesick for my friends. And I joined a group, and they didn't do this commitment thing where you all go, you know, all over, and I missed that. I mean, I never went to an AA meeting by myself in my life. So I started a group. I called it Have Drunks Will Travel. And I signed up all my friends and a couple of my pigeons. I now was grown up and I had pigeons of my own. And we went riding all over the countryside. We had a wonderful, wonderful time. I raised my children in Birmingham. And you know, I don't really remember ever talking directly to them about AA. I do remember warning them that there was alcoholism in our family and that they, you know, they needed to know that. I wished my parents had done that, but I don't think they could. 1989, Hurricane Hugo. I was living in Charleston. I remember riding out of town. I bet you a lot of you guys remember riding out of town thinking maybe you'll never see anything that you own ever again. When we came back into town, our whole first floor had been totally flooded. 30 years of journals and children's little drawings and all that stuff just gone. Furniture all gone. The tools that my husband's father had given for him to work with, that he'd worked with all his life doing his carpentry, gone. And I remember hitting that front door, seeing that awful scene in that living room, all the pluff mud. It was awful. It stank. It's hard to walk into your house and see it destroyed, you know. I remember going upstairs, finding a piece of paper, sitting down, and writing a gratitude list. I thought, this is kind of funny, you know. This isn't this isn't what I used to do in my green drinking chair. The first thing you think of is going upstairs and writing a gratitude list. That's a different person. That's a very different person than came in to this AA thing. About a year and a half ago, 4 years ago, my mother had a stroke. My husband had two heart attacks. A little later, about 2 years ago, my mother fell and broke her hip. And my husband became very sick. And we were told that he has an illness, which is progressive, untreatable, and that we should make the best of what we had. And for 2 years, we've been living with that. And living with it, I think, really well. Really well. My son, the medical student now, brought my husband here this evening. He's well enough to be here tonight, and I'm really glad he came. And my son brought his wife and Nicholas, one of my little grandchildren. I've learned, again, things that I learned when I first came here. You know, I forget so fast. I forget to live one day at a time. I forget to put first things first. I forget to keep it simple. And I have to come to meetings a lot. I think I've started going probably to twice the number of meetings that I went to before this news came into our home. And AA has made all the difference. It's just made all the difference. It's made every day, not every day a good day, but every day a much better day than it was going to be. I don't want to drink again. I don't ever want to drink again. I don't want to go back to being that very arrogant, very lonesome, very self-absorbed woman who can only think about another coffee cup full of gin. I don't ever want to go back there. And I think that the reason we're here together tonight is because none of us want to go back there. And we're here, and we can look in each other's eyes and wrap our arms around each other and be truly glad that we don't have to visit this on our families, our friends, the people we work with. It's a gift. It's a tremendous gift. And I'm very grateful. I'm impressed. I just want to finish by saying I'm very impressed because, first of all, it's to me a very extraordinary thing to be asked to speak at a convention in your own hometown. It's a little scary. I mean, when this is over, I don't get to like jump in a vehicle and drive 500 miles home. I don't get to leave the scene of this accident. I got to stay here. It's a tremendous honor and blessing. And a young woman named Carol called me two or three times to make sure that everything was comfortable for my speaking. They were thoughtful enough to say that if my husband needed nurses or anyone to sit with him in case he wasn't feeling well this night, they would have people at my house. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no other place like that. And I have to say a word about Florence, who called and asked me to speak. Because what really dazzles me is Florence asked me to speak at this meeting tonight, and she actually knows me. So she should know better. I know that this convention is going to go beautifully because there's so many people just here on this Thursday night. I hope to be here for some of it. I'm very grateful to have been here to share with you. I want to thank the people that came to hear me, my friends, and God bless you.